Greetings, Sleepy Salsa here on this Saturday, April 7th of 2012, and welcome to the 48th episode of the Last Bastille podcast. This broadcast is kindly hosted over at youhavetreadonme.com, and tonight it's also simultaneously streaming over at truthfindersnetwork.com. I will also take this opportunity to mention that the opening theme is Ashley Alicize's A Puzzling Predicament, and the outro will be Bosa's King's Quest, both of them available pursuant to Creative Commons Attribution, specifically CC BY NC SA 3.0 Unported. For more information on Creative Commons, visit them at creativecommons.org. For any other content that may not be of original authorship by yours truly, any such material is used under the sincere intention of fair use. If you wish to understand the nature of the situation we are all suffering under and what can be done about it, feel free to visit the Last Bastille blog, which is located over at Bastille is spelled B-A-S-T-I-L-L-E, thelastbastille.wordpress.com. The blog is also now available in Hypertext Transfer Protocol Secure Socket Layer, known vernacularly as HTTPS. We will be taking calls all throughout this broadcast. The call-in number, courtesy of Truth Finders Network, is area code 615-713-1098. Again, that is area code 615-713-1098. 713-1098. One more time, area code 615-713-1098. The chat room, located at http://yhtom.chitango.com, as well as on youhavetreadonme.com/radio and truthfinders.chitango.com will simultaneously be available as well. Also, it is imperative that any questions be constructive and on topic as much as possible. Believe me, although it is hard to not get off on tangents, staying on tonight's subject will be much appreciated, especially for the sake of the listening audience. If you have questions, please limit it to something we have covered or are currently discussing. As an added courtesy, please mute your mic when we bring you in until we announce you by name. This episode, we are going to focus on a particular monetary reform proposal. Humans have traded with each other since the beginning of time. Money was supposed to overcome the limitations of barter, but we have all seen how easy it is for those who have control of the purse strings to manipulate the economy. It is one thing for oligopolies to enjoy government privilege at the expense of competitors, employees, and customers. However, it is entirely worse for the state to grant a literal monopoly in the issuance of credit and currency to a corporate bank. Such dictatorial control over the money supply renders any notions of popular, minarchist government nothing more than a simple fairy tale. Our guest tonight is Gary Hunt. He is a writer, constitutional scholar, and patriot organizing consultant. Tonight we'll be discussing his monetary reform proposal. With that said, let us turn to our guest. Gary, are you with us? All right. If you will just bear with us for just a few minutes, folks, we will try and get the illustrious and very well-renowned Gary Hunt live on the air with us. All right, looks like we are experiencing a few technical difficulties, but if you just bear with us, we will definitely appreciate it. In any case, if one of you guys in the chat room could let me know if you guys can hear me and that sort of thing, I would greatly, greatly appreciate it, even though I know it's about a minute delayed or so. But yes, I do think it's important to examine just how we can move from the current situation that we're in, where you have a central bank that, of course, is dictated in the one of the planks of the Communist Manifesto, is that you actually have to have a central bank. How we transition from the situation we currently have, like with the Federal Reserve, and get to something where we can, frankly, something really better, something that doesn't involve lowering the purchasing power, something that doesn't involve taking people's sweat equity, if you will, and totally just rendering it almost null and void. And basically, it's a form of theft and that sort of thing. Okay, great. Thanks, Randy. I appreciate it. And thank you, Carrie, for letting me know. And thanks, Philo. You too, buddy. So hopefully we will get started in just a few moments or so. But yes, we are streaming live. Let's see, what is going on here? This is interesting. Okay. All right. Well, sorry about that, folks. Sometimes these things do happen, but I'm glad that the experiment with having a concomitant live stream over at TFN is good. So this is, if anything, this is a really good to have and that sort of thing. So we are going to try and to give this another go around. Let's see if we can try and make something happen here, because that is very exciting. But you know, let's also keep something in mind, guys, because yes, Randy, it's funny when you have stuff going live because there can be technical issues, but that's fine. So just while we get things going, keep in mind, guys, that there's a difference between gold bugs and greenbackers. Gold bugs are the guys who want to have a precious metal backed currency of some sort precious metals to back the currency, and greenbackers usually want it done completely by the government. All right, looks like we are pretty much good to go. Let us go and try this again. Gary, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Awesome. How are you doing this fine evening, sir?
Fine, except I thought it was 9 o'clock for the show instead of 8 o'clock Eastern, and so I apologize for being late.
It is perfectly fine. I'm just glad that our little simultaneous thingy with TFN is so far going through quite well. Well, let's go ahead and get started with your monetary reform proposal, which you called an economic solution. Gary, why did you write this?
Well, there were a number of reasons. There's all this talk about end the Fed, audit the Fed, and people seem to think if they close the Fed down tomorrow, we'd be fine. They don't think of how they'd buy bread and milk for the baby. And so it needed clarification that it's just a more complex issue than shutting down the Fed or auditing the Fed. Auditing the Fed would probably take 5 years at least. Congress would mess with it for a year or two trying to figure out what the audit conditions were going to be, since it's a rather unique organization. And then they'd probably give a couple of years to the Federal Reserve to decide to go ahead and complete the audit, since it was unique and kind of fruitless, really. And then people talk about going back to gold and silver. There are problems with going back to gold and silver, however, and they deal primarily with how much gold is there, how much silver is there, and if we get it again. A guy named McFadden wrote some letters in 1912, or spoke to Congress in 1912, 1913, and he was talking about tons of gold leaving New York Harbor every day. So the problem with gold currency is that if it leaves the country, then we reduce the monetary base for the country. And as the population expands, we need to expand the monetary base, not reduce it. I guess the final reason, the one that really prompted me to go ahead and put down the thoughts I'd have over the years on paper, was the fact that I wrote something called the Plan for Restoration of Constitutional Government. And in writing that, one thing that has to be addressed was what to do about the economic situation. And the plan itself is rather lengthy. So I wrote a lot of what I call asides. They were links that are in the plan that you go to for if you're interested in the specifics of that realm. And so I had to write it to complete the plan for restoration of constitutional government. I didn't have much choice.
And right. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there was also some things in the Under One Banner petition that did mention about banking.
The Under One Banner petition did mention about banking, and there is not as complete. The petition addressed it, and it said basically, I don't recall the exact wordings, told Congress to get their act together and start looking out for the people and abiding by the Constitution. And so it didn't go into specifics at all in the petition. The petition is written not to give the detail or write the bills for Congress or anything else. The petition is to tell Congress, do your job, and here's what you've got to do in a general terms, because we pay them. We elect them and pay them to do the detail. They haven't done the detail in the right direction, but it was just to get them back on track. So it wasn't really necessary, even though when I was doing the petition, I was thinking the same thoughts that went into this economic plan.
Right. So to be clear, would it be accurate to say that your monetary reform proposal is concomitant or otherwise syncs nicely with both the plan as well as the petition?
Well, yes, if Congress ever chose to do the petition. The petition, you know, it has an interesting background itself. Its purpose is to, like it was in 1774-5, its purpose is to convince guys like John Dickinson that the king ain't going to bend and Parliament ain't going to bend and there is no peaceful solution. There are a lot of people that keep trying all these different avenues to correct something, and occasionally there's a win. They get a bill defeated for this year anyway, or they might even get something repealed. But during that same time that they've exerted all that energy in that direction, what they have accomplished is one step forward and 7, 10, 15, 30 steps back. And the petition, unless the Congress took the whole thing and addressed every one of the issues, the election part, legislation, the war part, all the different campaign contributions, banking and everything, took a big sweep back towards it, we would see the failure of their ability to act, which is exactly why the Olive Branch petition was sent out to Parliament back then. So the petition's purpose is really for the people that sign it and then realize that nobody's going to do a damn thing. Now, they get upset when they do a Second Amendment petition and machine guns aren't made legal again. But on specific issues, those people get upset. They stay upset at 6 months, and then the people that have signed a petition to audit or in the Fed, you know, they send the petition in, an electronic petition or something, online petition, and they wait for something to happen. And all these people are waiting, and when you wait, that energy dissipates that you had in collecting the signatures, and you wait and wait and wait and wait, and just the energy dissipates.
Right,
so unless
right.
You can consolidate all that energy to be frustrated at the same time, it's kind of hard to think of any possibility of a solution, so it has to be broad enough to incorporate all the groups into participation at the same time, joining together under one banner and saying, Congress, do your job. And, you know, if Congress got say 100,000 signatures on 30 different petitions, they'd have 3 million signatures, or 1% of the population. Well, that's not very impressive if it's 300 different documents, but if they had 3 million signatures on a single petition, and each petition was one piece of paper, I don't know how to measure the thickness of a piece of paper, but that would be a high stack, and that would actually be 9 million petitions, because the petition goes to a representative and two senators. So now we've got volume, not in numbers on a single sheet, but in single sheets. We've got three single sheets for each signature, signatory to the petition, and so you've got enough paper there to fill one congressman's office to the top, probably, with 3 million signatures.
Right, exactly. And, you know, just for the listeners, for more information on the petition, please consult both the previous episode, episode 47, as well as episode 44, Outpost of Freedom, which was actually the last time I had you on, Gary, for more information on the petition. But yeah, the only reason I wanted to bring it up this go around was section 2 of the list of the demands on the petition was all about banking. Yes. So that kind of really is kind of leading really into your monetary reform plan. So, guys, I just want to kind of illustrate how a lot of this stuff is very much in synchronicity, I guess you could say. Well, all right. So,
well, perhaps on banking, it says stop all fractional reserve banking immediately. Now, that can stop immediately with no detrimental effect. Then it says create no additional currency, Federal Reserve notes, for circulation. Begin planning for greenback, full faith credit and credit of the United States without interest or surcharge, and gold and silver-based currencies. Plan withdrawal from Federal Reserve Act to be accomplished within 5 years. Now, those are the four items under banking on the petition.
Right.
And, yes, that's very general. And the economic plan then goes into a little more detail regarding accomplishment of those objectives.
All right.
Like I said, that would be for Congress to figure out. They've got general instructions on that. The specific instructions were written in the plan, or the solution.
Right. All right. So let's get into it. Gary, what is fractional reserve lending, also known as fractional reserve banking? What is it?
Well, without giving a complete education as far as where the money comes in the first place, just say the Federal Reserve comes into $100 million. Well, they can loan that out then to the tune of about $900 million. The theory is quite simple, and it goes back historically to, if I'm keeping your gold in my bank, you're going to keep your gold in my bank. And so I can figure that, say, if I've got $1 million in the bank, that nobody's going to, you know, I can loan out that money and get interest on it. But you're not going to come and ask for the money, and when I loan it out, they owe back to the bank. So if I loan out more than I really got in the bank, I can make more interest off of money I don't have. Well, fractional reserve banking allows that to about 900%, or that $100 million can be loaned out to the tune of $900 million, or almost $1 billion. That's fractional reserve banking. It's the assumption that the withdrawals will not come to take the money out of circulation. And that has to stop, because that causes inflation and that causes debt. And if we look at the monetary system now, everybody's right, it is debt-based. And I think the best explanation of that is we went through a transition in 1933. Gold was taken off the market. In 1968, silver was taken off the market. Now, I don't know what candy bars cost in 1933, but I know in 1951, they cost a nickel. And in 1968, they cost a nickel. They might have gotten a little smaller, or you could get a bigger candy bar for a dime. But there was not much in terms of inflation in that, say, 16, 17 years. When gold went off the market, and there was no fixed amount of currency anymore. It could be electronic. It could be printed in the printing mills of the Treasury Department. That money begins to flow in, and it's borrowed into circulation. Inflation began, and now nickel candy bars cost about 30 times what they cost back in 1968. And it's only been three times longer. So we had almost a doubling, perhaps, in the 16 years, and now we've got 30 times much reduction in buying power of the dollar is what it amounts to. That's inflation. There's more dollars in circulation. There's a balance between goods and currency, so the currency has less effect. It buys less because there's more of the currency in the marketplace. A good analogy on the money system, though, the Federal Reserve notes, is if we had not gone through the transitions in 1933 and 1968, if all of a sudden we open this new country and open up new currency and it all came from the source it comes from now, then there's no Federal Reserve notes in circulation. So I walk in the bank and I say, I want to borrow $100,000. I want to start a business. Okay, do you have some collateral? Yes, I have a house. It's free and clear. How much is it worth? $200,000. Okay, we'll be glad to loan you $100,000. So they give you $100,000, sign here, and you're walking out of the bank with a big smile on your face. You got $100,000 in one hand, and you're reading the contract in the other hand, and just simple interest. It says in 1 year you have to pay back $110,000. Well, wait, there's only $100,000 in existence, but I've got to pay $110,000 back next year. So somebody is going to have to borrow that $10,000 into circulation, and I'm going to have to acquire it to take that borrowed into circulation money with my borrowed into circulation $100,000 and go back to the bank and pay that $110,000. In the meantime, the bank has my property as collateral. Now, if you just think this out, eventually the bank will own everything in this country that's under mortgage. And if you default on that, they take your property. So it's a transfer of property to the banks in the long run. There's not enough M1 money in this country to pay off, but I don't know the current numbers, but back when I looked, about 7% of the personal debt. All the dollar bills in this country will pay about 7% of the personal debt. That means 93% of the collateralized property belongs to the bank already because it can't be paid down. Now, I don't know where electronic currency comes into this. When I looked at the numbers back in the 90s, it was based on just the circulating money, and I don't know what changes there have been. But the fact is, the banking system now, with everything borrowed out and collateralized, is a transfer of ownership of property. If you consolidated that all that money in a few hands, you could pay off 7% of the personal debt. But more than likely, it's not going to be. People might be lucky to pay off 2 or 3% of that personalized debt because this guy's got dollars, can't pay his off, but he ain't going to give his dollars to me so I can pay mine off. So I can't get more than I've got. So unless I've got more cash now than I owe, I'm going to lose property. The collateral, the foreclosure will occur, and the property will transfer. So that's fractional reserve banking. They're stealing property with it, basically. And they are causing inflation by this massive distribution of money into the marketplace, watering down the buying power of what we should have on hand. If we had gold and silver, that would be a stable number. Without stable number, what's called fiat currency, that number just keeps going up and eventually might achieve what they call hyperinflation, where I guess there was a joke down in Argentina when they were going through hyperinflation. They said, if you're going to take a bus, take some extra money because the price might go up before you get to the bus stop. And then we hear of Germany and Italy during their depressions, were wheelbarrows full of money, were needed to buy a loaf of bread. That some African country recently recounted their currency. They got rid of the $1, $5, and $10 million notes and renamed what the money was. And that happens after hyperinflation because you've got to take a wheelbarrow full because the buying power has been reduced so much that $1,000 or $10,000 is enough to buy a candy bar. And so if I want to buy something substantial like a car or a dinner out, I've got to carry a satchel full of money. So somewhere along the line, you end up regrouping and say 1 million old dollars is worth 1 new dollar. And now it's easy to carry around. I'm only carrying one instead of a million of those things around. That's hyperinflation. It's something that is a real potential in this country. I think we're beginning to realize it. So that's fractional reserve banking.
All right. So here's the other thing, too, is that, you know, I've been hearing grumblings from various people about, you know, they don't like usury or whatever. So, Gary, why can't interest just be abolished?
Well, it could. So could lending money. A lot of houses, you know, I'm a surveyor and I had to look through old deeds, and I saw a really large number of houses in Central Florida that were sold what was called mortgage to deed. That means that I'm going to sell you my property, and here's the terms of the mortgage, and when it's paid off, then the deed matures in your favor. The that works. Now, if I want to charge interest because I'm holding that note and it's going to take 10 years for me to pay it off, what's unreasonable about me being out the money and getting a little return on that? But let's look at a more realistic situation, at least nowadays, and I want to buy that house. And so I go to the bank. Well, people think the bank should loan the money without charging interest. Interest and usury are basically the same thing. The word means the same thing. Or the word usury could mean excessive, and I'll get to that in a minute. But I go down to the bank, and they've got this money there that people have deposited, their gold coins or whatever, and I want to borrow it to buy the house, so I borrow the gold coins, and I buy the house with it, and I get the deed, and I have a mortgage with the bank, but I have the deed now, and the bank has the mortgage as collateral. So it's not much difference to the mortgage to deed, but except I've got a third party that until that mortgage is satisfied, the deed has a lien on it. And then I get the release of lien, and then I own the property. So the bank's sitting there. It's a building. It had to build a safe to keep the gold in, and it's got employees to take the money in and put the money out. And in the meantime, they're paying interest out to people who deposit their money with the bank, to encourage them to put their money with the bank rather than in a coffee can in a hole in the backyard. So without interest at all, how do they pay for the bank? How do they pay for the salaries of the people who work there? How do they pay interest on the money that they're using to loan to you? It's non-functional. Now, I hear that the Muslims have banks that don't charge interest. I don't know how they work. I haven't looked into it, and I don't really care to, but I can't conceive of how you could possibly borrow somebody else's money, impose upon them a risk even. Say if I buy a car and I wreck the car and don't have insurance, he's got nothing in the collateral. So he's taking a risk, and he's got to cover the expense of his operation. So in the economic solution, I say that, let me back up a little bit. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, Jimmy Carter was president, and all of a sudden interest rates went sky high, and a lot of states had usury laws then, and I think Florida limited usury to 8%. That means nobody in Florida could charge more than 8% interest. I think that's a little high, but they had to get rid of those laws because the economy was just in such a state that everybody was borrowing money. Now, interest rates go up when too many people borrow money because they can't have too much going out at one time. They got to slow the borrowed money out. They go down when people aren't borrowing enough to pay back into the system, that $10,000. So the manipulation of the interest rate by the Federal Reserve is to adjust the flow of money, keep it constant so that inflation is slow and progressive to avoid hyperinflation, but then they'll lower the rate when people might be running into default, so that more people can borrow money out and it'll circulate, and then people can pay their mortgage, principal interest on the mortgage. Now, 3% also comes from something that I recognize from my lifetime. My parents bought a house in Rolling Hills, California. It was $18,500, and the interest rate with the GI Bill was 1.5%. But from what I recollect, the maximum rate in California at the time for a mortgage was 3%. The banks made money. The bankers still had one of the nicest houses in town, and people were content. So it's functional at 3% if you don't have too many people grabbing a slice of the pie. Now, when the Federal Reserve makes this $900 million loan to local banks, they charge interest on it, and there's interest on top of interest on top of interest. And all of these people all the way through this thread are making phenomenal salaries, then it's draining more out. And when it's used for manipulation, it has a detrimental effect too. But if we look at just a year or two ago, when interest rates for homes got down around 4%, if you were a qualified buyer, that it can function at that. But when we have fluctuating interest rates, we've got manipulation of the economy. When we've got fixed interest rates, it's not as susceptible to manipulation.
Interesting. Okay. Something I also noticed about your proposal was, you know, you were talking about internal versus external money. So am I correct in assuming that when you speak of internal versus external money, your intention is to clarify whom the wealth is being held by?
Not necessarily, no. There's nothing that would limit the holding of wealth, at least on the external currency. It serves a number of purposes, and one of them is one that I've not heard anybody else address. Now, I'm not an economist, and so there may be fault with that, and I'd love for some economists to look over the plan and tell me if there's fault with this. But suppose we had two currencies, and the internal currency was based on gold and silver, and gold and silver certificates were issued by the government based on the money in Fort Knox. That's a fixed base. That's what we used to have in this country. Banks would issue notes based on gold they had on deposit in their bank. When I was a kid, I used to collect coins, and I had a few gold coins that were minted by San Francisco banks. They would take the gold and their bank, then the name of that bank was assurance of the integrity of the gold, because the government wasn't involved in quantifying it, both as far as having 98% gold or whatever the standard was and the right weight. All they did is fix the weights, what weights should be, and the value of gold. And any bank could mint them then. So we would have a fixed currency internally. Now, the reason the gold would stay in Fort Knox is quite simple. So what McFadden talked about, and I said 1913 earlier, 1932, 1933, when tons of gold was leaving New York Harbor to go to Europe, that created a problem. It created a crisis in this country because Federal Reserve notes came in to circulation in 1913, 20 years before then. The banks would acquire the had the Federal Reserve notes, and you know, if you put gold in the bank and the bank didn't promise repayment in gold, they could give you Federal Reserve notes for your gold when you came to get your money out of the bank. So that was kind of problematic. You were doing paper for paper, so it took 20 years for people to get used to this. But then the bankers were keeping the gold certificates and redeeming them for gold, storing that gold on ships and shipping it to Europe. So all of a sudden, we ended up with a depression that was only ended by World War II and the high rates of production that we had to go into. So the removal of gold, the larger value of the two silver metals, the removal of that in massive quantities is what led to the depression. It turned everything upside down. So you can't have that happen. And so the internal currency, unless it's circulating gold, you know, I don't think the government should say that you and I can't exchange gold coins. But the government, anything they issue would have to be based on the gold in Fort Knox. And there would be audits every, I forgot how many years, I said 2 or 3 years in here, to make sure that there were no more dollars in circulation or based on gold or silver than there was actual gold or silver for. No fractional banking on this thing by putting out more silver or gold certificates than there was on deposit. So that keeps a fixed economy in this country that can be appended upward. If there's not enough currency, then people will go, well, gold's kind of interesting. When the price of gold goes up, a lot of people go into mining operations where they didn't before. They couldn't afford to before, but it becomes viable. Back when gold was $400 an ounce back in the 70s, for example, nobody wanted to mine gold. But now that it's $1,600, gold mining operations are picking back up. And technology's provided a better means of extraction of gold. We can extract larger amounts of gold from soil with small particles of gold than we could before, and without the detrimental processes that were used back then, using arsenic for the separation, or cyanide, one of the two. I guess it was cyanide they used for separation of gold from other particles. But that keeps us a fixed economy in this country and provides stability, so that the nickel candy bar will still cost a nickel 50 years from now, 100 years from now. The external currency, though, and one of the problems we have in this country, and if we look back at gold going out of the country, how much gold would we have to ship to China right now to buy these little toys that break within 10 minutes of their being played with? So we'd be losing our gold or devaluing the basis of our currency by shipping gold to China. So if we had external currency, and I call them U.S. trade dollars, it would be different, because the value of U.S. trade dollar would not be the same as the internal dollar. It would be higher or lower based upon the balance of trade. So it would, if the balance of trade was even, then the external dollars would be close to the value of the internal dollars. If we had great debts to China, then the external dollars would be worth a lot less. So it would take, like, for one internal dollar, if I want to buy a product from China, I might only get, well, say 100 internal dollars, I might only get $30 in trade value. So that means that I'm better off to buy what I want in this country, which would mean industry would come back because there's competition. Now, it's not protectionism, which I think is a bad deal, but it defeats protectionism by letting the marketplace balance that out. So when we have less trade with China and more exports going out of our country, then that trade dollar begins to come back up to be nearly equal with the internal dollar. If we export even more stuff, that external trade dollar is worth even more than the dollar. So that we can buy goods back a lot cheaper. If my $100 now will buy 500 trade dollars, then I can buy a lot more than I could when my $100 bought 30 trade dollars. So it tends to balance trade between nations. And trade with other nations is an absolute necessity in this world. We don't have all the natural resources or the abilities to produce certain things that we need. But it's gotten out of hand, and this would put it back in hand. We'd find computers and televisions and refrigerators and cars made more in this country by having those two currencies, and them balancing the marketplace between internal and external by a natural process of if we import too much, we can't import more because the value goes down. If we export too much, we're in a benefit, but chances are other countries then won't appreciate our dollars as much. So it tends to force a balance in the balance of trade.
Now, something else I noticed when I was perusing your proposal was you were mentioning this difference between, like, A, B, and C monies. So why does there need to be a distinction between, quote-unquote, illegal domestic and internationally held monies, C, versus legal held money domestically, A, and internationally, B, as described in the your proposal?
There's three grades, directly convertible money in circulation. The money circulating in the United States is real money. It's what you've got in your wallet right now, or theoretically in the bank. Now, a lot of bank money is unfortunately, electronic right now, but it's money that you've earned and put cash in, even if it was an automatic deposit or anything else. And that's legitimate money. It was earned fairly, and you have every right to receive that value back. There's a lot of other cash in circulation, or I guess you could call it out of circulation, and I'm sure some of you have seen the pictures of them. If you go down to Mexico, you go to some of these houses, you'll find rooms filled with $100 bills. They have tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. They don't know what to do with it. They've got so much. They don't burn it for firewood, but they, you know, you've seen the rooms and the amount of money confiscated in some sort of the United States Customs Service or some. Now, that's illegal money, and there's probably other illegal money. So the A is classed in two parts, the legal money that you earned for doing your job, and the illegal money that was acquired by illegal means or nefarious circumstances, things like that. B then was money that's circulating internationally I didn't get that quite right, did I? That's C money. Okay, let's see. Let me review my own work. I was going to before the show, but it just snuck up on me. Money circulating internationally is B money, and that depends on where it comes from. And I'll use an example. Bill Gates has made $64 billion. How much of that was made in Europe? See, that should be B money. It was made in Europe. It wasn't made here. And so you'd have to look at Bill Gates, and if he made 40% of his in foreign and 60% internal, then he would get 60% in internal dollars and 40% in United States trade dollars, because they came from trade. And the thing is, let's see, the amount of money there is now, especially counting electronic, is phenomenal in its numbers. It is far beyond the ability to be reasonable, and this is a result of that fractional reserve banking. And if we allowed every dollar that was made by any corporation overseas and then converted to U.S. dollars to count against the internal money, the problem is we've got a hoarding problem. We've probably got 95% of the money in the hands of 5% of the people, and that leaves very little for purchasing power in this country. So if it's made out of country, it has to go to trade dollars at whatever the determined rate is. And as far as determining rate, that's addressed in the economic solution as well. So A is the legitimately circulating money, and C is that money that stacked in closets in Mexico, and B is the money that might have been made overseas legally but should not credit against the base for the valuation of the dollar or gold in this country until it's distinguish between whether it was earned internally or externally. Did that clear it up? I got off to the wrong start on that. But
I think so, unless the listeners would like more qualification on that. I did want to keep going and ask you, I noticed also elsewhere in the proposal that you mentioned about a redemption process. Gary, why does there need to be a redemption process?
Well, here comes the tricky part. How do we convert this? Let's see. If we're going to go to greenback dollars, what we've got to do first is identify the A money and the B money, the valid money, the portions of B that are valid and the A money. And to do that, we've got how would you count it? Okay, everybody, count your dollars and send a note to the U.S. Treasury Department and tell them how much you've got. Or the best way to do it is the same thing they did when they took gold out of circulation and silver out of circulation. In 1968, I had a bunch of silver certificates. I could go down and trade them for silver. And if you went to the bank, then you'd get half dollars and quarters and silver dollars because the bank still had silver. But after that was done, silver was no longer a circulating currency. So there was a redemption time. You had so much time to turn your silver certificates in to get full value for them in silver. Otherwise, they would be replaced with Federal Reserve notes. So I took mine down. In fact, I remember my last silver certificate, I'd gotten to Daytona Beach, Florida. I was starting at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, and I needed to get a haircut. And I watched that last silver certificate that I had go to the barber that day. The redemption time then. So everybody has to convert what they've got into something tangible without them sending a note to the Treasury Department. So you go to the bank and you say, I want to convert the money in my bank account, all earned here, no international banking associated with it, all earned here to greenback dollars. So you get greenback dollars in the equal value. Now I want to turn in all the FRNs for greenback dollars at current value, and maybe all the coins too. Now we've got an idea, and I'm going to stop right there. This has to also apply to the B currency, but we'll stick with the A for now. At this point then, after say a year of this redemption, everybody's turned in their FRNs. After today, ladies and gentlemen, your FRNs are good for what they've always been good for, absolutely nothing. And you can't trade them anymore, just like they did with the silver certificates. So now we know how many dollars have gone into circulation based on the greenbacks being issued, either for bank accounts where the bank has to keep the greenbacks on if they got your money in the bank, and if you got the money directly, then you get to keep the money that you have, the greenbacks. The FRNs are all gone. Now we can count the A money and the B money that counts, but we'll leave B out for now, but the same thing applies. We can count the amount of dollars that have been issued. And just, I'm going to use some ridiculously low numbers. Just say it's $10 billion. Okay, so we've got $10 billion in greenback dollars. Now we count the gold and silver in Fort Knox, and, you know, the government initially established a rate of gold being 20 times more valuable per ounce than silver. Now, that was changed in 1933 when it jumped up, gave 160% profit to those that had gold when it went to $32 an ounce. So I would be inclined to go back to the 1 to 20. So you take the little simple algebra, you take the ounces of gold that you've got and the ounces of silver you've got, and develop the ratio of 20 to 1 and say, okay, this is what we've got in currency. And if it's based on a dollar, we might only have $4 billion instead of $10 billion. So greenbacks, we only got $4 billion. Let's make it easy. Let's say $5 billion in gold and silver. So we've got two choices at that point. We issue gold and silver certificates at 50 cents on the dollar for the greenbacks and retire the greenbacks, and that's the easiest way, or we look at readjustment of all prices based on a reduced buying power when we issue the gold and silver notes at $1 and $20 an ounce. But at that, the redemption is just that. That's the period at which an accurate count can be made of the amount of dollars and then compared with the amount of gold and silver available. And so the adjustment is made on the reissue of gold and silver notes. For example, I imagine if we did that, nickel candy bars would again cost a nickel. It would push it back down to that level. So the redemption is just that counting period where we can see what we owe and how we got to divvy up the gold and silver to make it balance. Now, the gold and silver, though, stays in Fort Knox, as I said earlier, because if not, people will manipulate the gold and silver and take it out of the country, and then they've destroyed the balance that we need to have a stable base currency.
Huh, okay. Now, why do FRNs need to be exchanged for U.S. greenbacks if what you ultimately want to do is return the United States back to a gold standard?
Well, it's part of the conversion. What do? With the FRNs? Tell the guys from Mexico, bring them up here, and you're going to have more gold in Mexico than we have here? The redemption is to qualify the dollars, where they came from, if they're legitimate. And for most of us who have just worked for a living, it's a straight across trade to the greenbacks, and then it's conversion to the balance between gold and silver at the next step after 1 year. But to just, if we continue with FRNs, how many are in circulation? Do you have any idea? Do you think anybody has any idea how many FRNs are in circulation? Does the government issue money when they know that there's, say, $100 million in a closet in Mexico? Do they go issue $100 million worth more dollars? The money they confiscate in Mexico, do they burn it, or do they put it in the banks, or do they put it in their own pockets? So you just need some way of going from A to B to C, and that is to do a conversion receipt, so to speak. I'm giving you a greenback receipt for your FRN. And when that's all done, I know exactly how many greenback dollars I've got out there. Now I can calculate the ratio of gold and silver. Absent that, do we do gold and silver based on the government's little table somewhere, that's, or the Federal Reserve Bank, whoever's got it, little table that says there are this many dollars in circulation? And if we do that, we have to discount that illegal money in Mexico and lost money and everything else. So we're going to reduce the value of gold, the value of the dollar, because there's going to be a lot more FRNs out there than there will be greenbacks issued in exchange to them. So we come off with completely disproportionate numbers when we go to, if we go directly from FRN to gold and silver certificates. And if we do that, we make it easier for those people to go down in their closets and start taking wheelbarrow folds of $100 bills and smuggling. What we would see then would be a lot of smuggling coming across the border, but instead of drugs, it would be $100 bills so that they could be redeemed. Now, if some guy comes into a bank with, $10 million in $100 bills and doesn't even speak English, obviously there's going to be a question, and there's got, some method has to be put in place to evaluate what his earning potential was and whether that's a valid exchange or not when he goes to get his greenbacks. But you have to have the total number to go out before you can count it versus gold and silver.
Now, why can't the gold and silver certificates be redeemable for those precious metals if the certificates themselves are backed by the actual metals at Fort Knox?
Well, how long would they last at Fort Knox if people went and redeemed all their gold and silver certificates, went up to the bank teller window at Fort Knox and said, "I want my gold"? Now, the problem is, I go up and I get my gold, and then what if I take it out of the country? Then I've disrupted that base. That's exactly what happened in 1932 and 33. The gold left the country, creating the greatest depression we've ever had. So it has to remain there. Now, the audit assures that there's no more currency out there and no gold or silver's disappeared. Now, as far as the audit gets into another area, but, I think some representatives of state government should be part of the audit team to make sure that there's so many ounces of gold and so many ounces of silver in Fort Knox. And that audit should be on a fairly regular basis to assure that it's not disappearing. But the problem is, when the rest of the world is on fiat currency, that gold and silver becomes very desirable. And I don't know if there's any country in the world that really has a gold and silver-based economy, but then those aren't republics like we are, and they don't have a constitution that requires gold and silver to be used in payment of debt. So we're unique in the world in that, would be unique in the world in that situation. But the flow out then would be phenomenal. So it's got to be kept in so that we have that stable base. Does that make sense to you, or do you have any questions about it?
I don't. Still waiting on the chat room if they have any questions about the gold and silver certificates that were mentioned in your proposal. Speaking about Fort Knox, though, who will perform the audit of Fort Knox's precious metals?
Well, I think it's in the best interest of the members of the union the states to determine how the audit will be performed and be major participants in it. That each state's government should have, you know, if they want a whole bunch of people, each state delegate one person from their the government to go to, you're in Texas. Texas would have one delegate go to be a part of the audit team to make sure it's there. I don't trust the federal government, you know, but, you know, I didn't go that far. Something could be established, but I don't, you know, that's going too far in recommendation. Hey, I could give names. I could say John Doe and Joe Smith and, oh, this guy, Edwin Griffin, he would be a good one, I think. But that's going too far. I mean, this is a solution, but it's not to the finite detail. It can't be. It's not my decision to make, number one. I'm just laying out what I think would achieve the purpose. But I do think that every state should participate, or at least the state should determine the nature of the audit and the frequency and who the auditors were.
Okay. Now, speaking about precious metals, who will mint, guarantee, or participate in the circulation of gold and silver?
Well, there won't be circulating gold and silver. There could be. I mean, if a bank got gold and wanted to issue gold coins or gold certificates like they did 100 years ago, based on gold on deposit in their bank, they could. Now, once it goes into Fort Knox, it stays in Fort Knox. If it's out of Fort Knox, I've got gold coins now. I don't think I'd entrust the government with them. I think I'd keep them just in case something went wrong. There's nothing wrong with that. But the money that's issued by the United States Treasury Department as gold and silver certificates can never diminish. It can only go up by additional gold being placed in Fort Knox. What circulates otherwise outside of that will still have equal value, because if I'm willing to trade my 1 ounce of gold for your $20 gold certificate, that's my choice or not to accept it. And that's what happened between 1913 and 1933, but people had trouble accepting it then. But after a while, after a generation, they began accepting it, so the banks ended up with the certificates, took the gold, and took it out of the country. Now, if it's circulating, the government's never had it, never issued certificates on it, that's private. Somebody takes their private gold out of the country, they have every right to it. It's a free country. But the basis of currency issued by the United States Treasury Department cannot be reduced. It has to be, it can only go up, it can never go down.
All right. Now, also you mentioned your proposal about United States trade credits. Gary, what are United States trade credits?
Well, I said United States trade dollars earlier. Trade credits is the phrase that I used. But that's something that... again, back if I had $100 and wanted to buy some goods from China, the trade dollars now, because of the imbalance in trade and the debt we owe to China, would probably be worth only $30 in the trade credits, the external dollars. And so I can't buy very much in China, which means I'm better off to buy it here. Now, as American manufacturing comes back into existence. Motorola was the last company in this country to make televisions here, and that was back in the 70s. When Motorola starts making televisions again, if they make a good one, I'll buy it, and it's going to cost a lot less than the Chinese version. And if it's good enough, then maybe the Chinese will be willing to pay a higher price for the American television. And as we start manufacturing and exporting, then that the value of that trade dollar trade credit will come up, and that's the equilibrium, the balance we're looking for, and it would be motivation for us to get back to what we used to be, which is the greatest industrial nation in the world, because we've got the means, we've got the know-how, we've got the capability. We just don't have the incentive now, and this would create the incentive. So it's to create an equilibrium. Now, let's say I want to go to a foreign country to on vacation. I can't take my internal dollars out of the country, so what I have to do is buy trade dollars at current value. So if I'm going to China, I only get $30, because that's all it's worth. Now, when I come back in this country, if I've got any trade dollars left, I can convert them back up to the internal currency. So it discourages travel, too. But remember, travel takes money out of this country. If I go to Europe and spend $10,000, that's $10,000 that stays in Europe. Now, if I did it with internal money, that means the gold and silver belongs to them. So the internal money cannot leave the country because the gold can't and the silver can't. So it becomes what you use when you go to a foreign country. You know, we use the MPCs in Vietnam, military payment certificates. They were a promise to pay. And the idea was, in a way, not much different than what I've been talking about. If a whole bunch of these, some poor farmer comes in with, you know, $50,000 in MPCs, they're going to question this guy and say, where'd you get those? You working for Charlie? You've been robbing GIs or what? So it was a way of keeping the MPCs were not supposed to be used on the economy. They were only supposed to be used in PX, at clubs, and, you know, within the military community. And if they went out, they weren't necessarily redeemable unless you found somebody that would redeem them. And so it's the same thing. It's to keep the money within our own context. Now, if I had a real $20 bill, silver certificate in Vietnam, it was worth probably $50 or $60, dollars worth of MPC if I went to the economy to buy piastre with it. If I had a $100 bill, it would be worth even more, a greater ratio, because it was a single bill that's worth more. So I could probably buy, well over 1,000 piastre or dollars worth of piastres with, at MPC rate with a $100 bill of Ben Franklin. But it's to stop that we need the internal currency, because the United States dollar has been in demand around the world for I don't know how long. I think just recently I read something that some countries have stopped using the dollar as the international counting currency. So we have lost the prestige that the U.S. dollar had held for, I don't know, at least 100 years. Going back to the early part of the 20th century, the U.S. dollar was one of the most respected currencies in the world. I think the pound was, and I'm not sure when the switchover was, but we would get back to that stature. But right now, U.S. dollars aren't appreciated like they used to be by us either.
Right. Okay. It looks like there's also been some activity in the chat room, some very interesting discussions, and also some pertinent questions. So let's now turn our attention over to that. Evenhand asks a bunch of stuff. Let's start with his comment. If there is a definite amount of material held in reserve, like gold, and there is a need to increase the money supply due to population growth, to offset a circumstance like the Whiskey Rebellion, what is the path to increase the money supply?
Digging in the ground, coming up with more gold and silver. There's an old story that's rather interesting about gold and silver. It's a small town, and there's 10 men in the town. 5 of them are tailors, and 5 of them are miners. Now, if one of the tailors dies and they're not making enough suits or clothes to satisfy the miners, the value of the suits goes up. When it gets to a certain point, one of the miners is going to give up mining and he's going to go back to be a tailor and start making clothes. And at that point, it tends to bring the cost to the miners of the suits down a little bit, because there is more supply to meet the demand. It's called supply and demand. It's a self-balance. The supply and demand marketplace is self-balancing. It was a supply and demand marketplace that made this country great. Once we got out of debt from the Revolutionary War, the economy tended to get very healthy. There were 7 depressions before the Great Depression, and all 7 of them were resolved within 2 years, and they were done without the intervention of government. Now, those depressions more than likely were a consequence of not enough dollars or too many dollars, that imbalance. but they tend to stabilize themselves because people will adjust to it, and it's a slow adjustment, but I become a tailor, or I go back to mining gold. Now, mining gold brings more into the economy, so that imbalance again, if suits get too high, I'm going to go mine gold and to buy the suits, and as it balances back the other way, then I'll go back to making suits. It just, you know, that's a natural process. I don't know how to define it. It sets itself out that it always has in this country, and there's no reason to believe that it won't continue to do so. There are still hundreds of tons, or if not thousands of tons of gold in the ground in this country, and it's just a matter of when the demand is there, people will go get it. I hope that answers your question, Boyd. I know that if we look at FRNs, nickel candy bars cost $1.50 now, and that is not the way to go, because what it's done is minimum wage went from $1.25 when I was a kid to, what, $8-something now, say $9 an hour. It's gone up, what, 4, 5, 6 times? Maybe 6 or 7 times.
It's a lot. It's pretty scary how much, yeah.
Yes, but the value of purchased goods has gone up 30 times. So let's just say it's 6 times higher with minimum wage, and it's 30 times higher for goods. Then I have 1/5 the purchasing power that I had with minimum wage then. When I was a kid, a friend of mine and I got an apartment. We paid $40 a month for that apartment. We were working minimum wage. Minimum wage with taxes and everything out was $1.25, was $50 less $10 for FICA and Social Security and everything. We got $20 or $40 in our paycheck, right about $40. So that was 1 week's pay for a 2-bedroom apartment. That was the buying power was great. Now you take. So I could have afforded it alone, but I would have had to skimp on food and going out drinking and things like that. But two of us split that, so it really cost us half a week's wage just to rent that apartment for a month. You take somebody on minimum wage now, he can't afford to rent an apartment. He's got to live with somebody. There's no way in hell he can pay the rent. Most apartments, I'd say when you get, in the cheaper areas, you're probably paying at least $800 a month for a 2-bedroom apartment. Now, $800 a month, and this guy on minimum wage at, say, $8 an hour is making $320 a week before taxes. And so that takes 3 weeks to pay the apartment. That means he doesn't get water, electric, internet, food, all the things he needs. The buying power has been diminished by the program we have now that keeps pumping money to accommodate growth, if you want to look at it that way. That's one of the arguments for the expansion of currency. But it just doesn't work. It's destructive, and you've got to understand purchasing power versus how we count dollars.
Right, exactly. And that's kind of the problem when you have the purchasing power being devalued so much like that, is that you can't even maintain a very basic living. Not even a bachelor who's living on a shoestring budget can even, at that point, I mean, so no wonder the homeless rate's been exploding, and unemployment is, we're actually at Great Depression levels right now. Actually, when you take a look at the real rate of unemployment, and unfortunately the CPI figures also don't account for the people that have given up job hunting. So
yeah, some of us know we're in depression, and the rest listen to the press who tell us how good the economy is.
Yeah, and they have to lie because they have to look good for their creditors, as well as the completely clueless mainline public who don't even know the basics of how of any sort of economic principles of any economic school, which is kind of a problem courtesy of the public fool system. But that's why we're trying to step in and kind of fill those gaps in. Now, the chat,
that that old definition of the best slaves are those that believe they're free.
Yep, exactly. Now, there's obviously been other things going on in the chat room, and I've kind of formed some additional questions based on things that the guys in the YHTOM chat room were kind of saying. And something I think would be good to clarify with you, can bartering, if commonly used, be used in conjunction with your proposal.
Why not? Banks can issue gold and silver coin, a gold and silver certificate, independent of the government. We're talking about the stability of the base being an obligation of the government, as it probably should be under the circumstances, to remain it stable. Now, the gold minted by the bank can go out of the country. There's no way to stop that. The gold minted by the gold certificates, though, cannot. However, when we look at if barter works, what is gold currency? Or gold? It's a medium of barter, isn't it? I've got a cow and you've got chickens, and I want, five or six chickens. I got two choices. Cut up the cow and then try and barter it to everything I need, new car and everything else, as quickly as possible before the damn thing rots, and have to carry that, 1,000-plus pounds around with me until I get all the chickens and other things, pots, pans, and goods I want. Or I find somebody who wants a whole cow, and he gives me gold for it as the value of the cow. Now, we've just bartered gold for cow. And now I've got something that I can carry in my pockets, and I can break it down into smaller pieces so I can go buy four chickens from you. So gold and silver-based currency is a medium of barter. It's nothing else. It's a recognized, identifiable value, and it's just a means of barter because I can't trade my big cow for your four chickens. Just don't get it. And especially if you live, 400 miles away and I want to buy something that you've got and I've got to run that cow 400 miles, I'm going to lose a lot of pounds of cow by the time I get them 100 miles unless I pay for a feed yard to get them back up like they used to in the old trailer days, to get them back up to weight. And that could take a couple months. So gold is a medium of exchange. Federal Reserve notes, they're a medium of exchange too because we accept them at value. Monopoly money's a medium of exchange. If I've got enough, I can buy Park Place or Boardwalk. So it's no different. But the problem is, when we use FRNs, that value doesn't remain fixed. So if I sell the cow now for FRNs and I wait 10 years to buy the chickens at the rate of inflation we've been going at, it might take the whole cow to buy the four chickens 10 years later because I've put it in FRNs if I put it in gold. And now here's another old saying about gold, and probably fairly true. Used to be said that it took 1 ounce of gold to buy a fine set of men's clothes. What does a good suit and pants cost nowadays?
Oh, it's well over $1,000 easily.
Well, that's well approaching the price of gold. My first suit cost $35 when I was a kid. I still remember it. I didn't want it, but my mother made me get it for my uncle's funeral. But it was $35, and she was kind of upset because that was more than we were still growing then. And I was probably 5 or 6 years old, and that was more than the mortgage payment. But she bought us the suits so we could go to my uncle's funeral in them. Now, in theory, gold was still $32 an ounce back then, and you could go down and buy it, unless it was collector coins, you could go down and buy I don't know if you could or not, but the gold was worth $32 an ounce then. And it didn't really begin changing until into the late 60s, about the time silver went off the marketplace. So the stability just went to hell, and this allows something interesting, too. With gold and silver, there can't be hoarding, because if Bill Gates hoards all the gold and silver notes that are issued by the government, then nobody's going to buy a computer. And if it's internal money, that means he has to spend it internally in this country so that people can buy his computers. If it's in FRNs being borrowed into existence at greater rates, he can keep hoarding. He can skim off 10% of that money that's going into circulation and put it in his bank account. But if it's gold and silver, he's got to spend it back or he ain't going to sell any more Windows 7s or Windows 8s or anything like that. So you can't hoard with fixed currency because it becomes self-destructive. And that's back to the analogy of the tailor and the miner.
Right. Now, Fox in the YHTOM chat room asks, or says, just to play devil's advocate, times have changed. How could we reasonably use gold in today's market? Would we get paid in gold pieces? And, or, you know, just in general, how exactly would that work?
Well, if your employer went to a bank and got gold pieces, yes. But if it was U.S. Treasury-issued money, it would be based on the gold and silver in Fort Knox, so you would get a gold or silver certificate. Or a check that was redeemable at a bank for gold and silver certificates. So, it's not any gold circulating or any silver circulating would be private money. When I say private, not federal government. States can't issue currency, so that leaves banks. And banks in the 1800s were minting coins. If you go to a coin show sometime and look at the gold and sometimes silver, but more often gold coins, you'll see they're minted by different banks. They had the right to mint money if they had the banks, so they made the coins. Now, some of them issued certificates as well, but they were supposed to retain that gold in bullion form in the vault, at least, if they were issuing currency for it. Now, the government does that. It just depends on the bank you go to. But the certificates are as good as gold, literally, because they are based on gold.
All right. Now, in the chat room earlier, there was some back and forth about this following, which I think is best expressed in this following question. Is money the same thing as currency?
Well, back 200 years ago, they called it specie because it was based on gold as opposed to currency. Now, we're getting into semantics because somebody on this program earlier called it money or something. I thought you said something.
If I did mispronounce it, I meant to say monies, but yes. But okay, yes, but I guess you could say there is an aspect of verbicide to it.
Yeah, we accept as money these pieces of garbage. Back in the 90s and 80s when I was getting into the Patriot community, I used to carry around a little drawstring bag, and in it I had a one-ounce silver ingot from, I don't know who manufactured it, kind of like the Credit Suisse does with gold. I had a silver dollar, I had a quarter, I had a half dollar, I had a post-64 dollar, a silver dollar, or sandwich dollar, a quarter and half, and probably had a post and pre-sandwich dime in there too, and I had a Federal Reserve note and a silver certificate, and I'd lay them all on the table. And asked, oh, did I owe you $1? And signed it, Gary Hunt. And I'd put these all on the table. And I asked people, which of these do you place value in? A lot of them really didn't understand that silver and sandwich coins were different. But most people did. And they would take the silver coins. They would take the silver certificate, even though it was no longer redeemable. They would even take my IOU before they would take the FRN. Because my word was better than the Federal Reserve Bank, I presume. The value of something is based on what's behind it. And in the case of the IOU, my word was behind it, and that was good enough for them. If a bank issues gold certificates, if you trust the bank, you accept the certificate. If you don't, if some bank just opened up yesterday and says BO's Bank of Boston, you don't take their currency, which is how it worked back in the mid-1800s.
All right. Now, something else that also kind of cropped up too. Is it accurate to say that money is debt?
Currently, yes. The analogy I gave before, where there's no money in circulation, guy walks into the bank, says, I want to borrow $100,000, and they loan it to him. It's borrowed. It's debt. It's borrowed in. It's actually owed back to the bank when you're done with it. And then there, on top of that, is that 10% interest, which means I got to bring $110,000 back to the bank in a year. Now, if nobody else brings into that money borrows any money into circulation, I'm out my house at that point because that was the collateral. So, yes, the money we have now is borrowed into circulation. It is debt. In fact, one of the, you know, FRNs is one term. Another one that I think is more appropriate, it's just more difficult to explain to people, is Federal Reserve Accounting Unit Dollar. Anybody want to put that together as an acronym? Federal Reserve Accounting Unit Dollar.
Fraud.
There you go. That's a good one. I like that. But yes, it is borrowed into circulation. Now, if it was gold and silver, it wouldn't be. You might borrow some gold and silver and pay interest on it until you return the principal and interest. But it's not borrowed into circulation because it has intrinsic value. It's got a fixed value that will always be there. So the difference between money now and money before 1933, let's go before 1913 because the Federal Reserve notes were issued in 1913-1914. It had a fixed value. It wasn't borrowed into circulation, and that value had very little change in its merit in the marketplace. And there were occasional distortions in that. A lot of it had to do with the rapid growth of a Western town, for example, where the growth was so great and people wanted to overinvest in building. Same thing that happens even now, where they overinvest in building and they can't find enough people then to rent or buy. You create an imbalance, a local imbalance, and it can spread out. If it happens in a larger city, it can spread even further. But they tend to balance themselves out because people spend less. Some people will spend less and other people will spend more. And eventually that those that spend more will circulate back into the hands of those that were spending less.
Now, as a follow-up to that, does it, you know, I've listened to other monetary reform theorists, and something was kind of brought up, and I wanted to ask you this. Does it matter whom the debt is owed to? And to clarify that, say, like, the difference between each of us owing each other the debt versus owing private bankers. So does it matter whom the debt is owed to if you are to have a debt-based currency?
Well, with a debt-based currency, there has to be a central focus. He who can issue the money, it will be owed to. The way it works now is the Federal Reserve Bank issues money to its member banks, and then they loan money out to the smaller banks, and they'll even loan money out to smaller banks. But the bottom line is the debt is owed to the Federal Reserve Bank, the Federal Reserve Board and Bank, that entity, which is a private corporation. And they've got they don't have a monopoly on the market because I can borrow $20 from you and pay you back. But for the most part, the currency in circulation was all borrowed into existence, and that $110,000 goes back to the Federal Reserve Bank. Or the collateral for it if I default on the loan. And the ones that hurt from foreclosure are the people that lose their houses, the people whose value of their property goes down as a consequence of reduced property values, and the Federal Reserve Bank, because they don't know what to do with all these houses. So everybody hurts in this current system when the economy goes south, as it has been doing the last 4 years. But in a goal-based system, you know who you're borrowing it from. You go to the bank, the money on deposit was by the townspeople, and this is how towns grew in the West. You know, people made money doing things, and they put it in the bank, and then the bank would load money out, and somebody could build a hotel. Now, the money that comes into the hotel and for the meals and everything, that goes in the bank, and there's more money to loan out. And the money is owed through the bank to the depositors in the bank, and the bank gets its difference. Like I said, when I was a kid, I think I got 0.5% on my Christmas account or my savings account. So that 1% between 2.5% spread between what I got paid for the savings account versus the 1.5% to 3% for a mortgage, the bank got its cut, its operating expenses out of that difference between the interest paid on the deposit versus the interest received on the loan, and. So, you know, back then, the beneficiary was me as a kid putting money in the bank, savings account, because I made money on my money, and that money that I made was not greater than the inflation rate because there was virtually no inflation rate. But now the inflation rate, if you look at the rate of inflation and you look at what you get on a savings account in the bank, if you put $100 in the bank today and your purchasing power is $100, at the end of the, a year, you'll have maybe $101 in the bank. And it's purchasing, but the goods to buy with that would be cost you $103 or $100 because of inflation, $103 or $104 or more dollars. So your purchasing power has been reduced by saving money now, and they keep trying to get us to save money. But back then, my purchasing power increased by putting money in the bank. But it all, remember, the Federal Reserve is the one that everything's paid back to now, except for personal loans. If you borrow money from a bank, they've borrowed it from the, rather than depositors, they borrowed it from the Federal Reserve. So the Federal Reserve is the one getting pretty substantial interest on what they loan to the banks. And the depositors' dollars really don't count that much anymore, which is why banks default, because they're allowed to use other means of justifying what their lending ratios can be over their deposit ratios. Those numbers have all changed. The laws that were passed back in the 30s to avoid another depression and rampant inflation and things like that are going by the wayside. I can't think of all the laws now, but you know, every once in a while Congress gets rid of another law and allows things to go back to what the same situation that existed before the Great Depression.
Now, there's also another concern that's been mentioned. Is there not a danger that precious metals can be cornered by despotic special interests?
Not if the gold and silver, at least in U.S. Treasury issued silver and gold certificates, is retained in Fort Knox. They can only transfer the notes. They cannot transfer the gold. And that is the primary reason, because we are the only country in the world, if we do this, we will be the only country in the world with specie as the foundation of our money. And if we allow that specie to leave the country, as we did back in 1932 and 33, then we destroy our own economy. So nobody can hoard it. If they hoard it, then they get into that situation I mentioned with Bill Gates. He's got all the money, and nobody can buy his computers. He's got to reduce the price of his computers, number one, but even then there's not enough money, so he's got to go spend money so it gets back into circulation to come back and buy the computers. Now we borrow money so that we can buy the computers. Most people I know finance their new computer when they get one. They finance their iPod sometimes. So if we get back to something stable, we get away from that. Because if nobody buys, if nobody has money to buy, therefore the people that sell have to get money into the hands of the people that buy. It's just a self-circulating, it's a marketplace that's self-balancing.
Now, for the benefit of the listeners, we are taking questions. So if you have questions, just go ahead and type